The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hey, good afternoon and greetings. Thanks for coming along for the Tuesday, March 12th edition of The Ride Home. It's an impeccably beautiful day across Western Pennsylvania, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh.
Lovely. Just lovely.
It's just beautiful out. It's one of those days I get up and think, I don't deserve this. It's just too incredible.
No, it's okay. You can deserve it.
All right. Thank you.
Very, very nice to be out there. Is your backyard blooming yet?
I haven't even looked.
For fear or
I
just
mean,
busyness?
For fear, actually.
Why?
Because I don't have enough time to get out.
To do some raking and digging and pruning.
I don't even want to know what's happening out there.
Plenty of time.
Yeah.
Right? So early.
And it was snowing sideways on Sunday night, just in case you're keeping track.
So you don't want to be out with pruning shears in the middle of a blizzard.
I just don't feel like it's appropriate.
No, of course it's not.
Coming up on today's show, John, in the 5 o'clock hour, how teens and parents approach screen time.
Mm-hmm. A new survey
from Pew.
Released yesterday. Uh-huh. What I like about it is when kids step away from their phones, they feel happier.
And my kids have said the same thing.
Of course. When you see the videos of like our generation, kids in the 70s, 80s, 90s, without their phones gathering, it's so nostalgic and it looks so much fun.
Doesn't it? It looks like, wow, they're all on bikes and they're all outside.
Just hanging out, laughing and talking. Yeah.
That's incredible. Anyway, we'll talk about that at 5:35. Also, generational curses. Is that a real thing?
That's a weird thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's a scripture passage, the sins of the fathers are visited on the children. I believe that's in Proverbs. What does that mean exactly? Anyway, Roger Olson's going to join us to talk about that. And also, the 7 keys to longevity.
Hmm.
One of them being drinking green tea iced like I do every day for the ride home.
Does that include tanning?
We're going to talk about tanning.
About tanning as well.
I forgot about the tanning
very
idea.
Good.
And in just a couple of minutes, we're excited to have a conversation with Mike Cosper.
Very nice. All that and more on the Tuesday edition of The Ride Home. But before we get underway, let's take a look at the news stories. Kath, give us the top 4 at 4.
For Tuesday, March 12th, John, 2024, number 1. Former President Donald Trump may be able to clinch the Republican presidential nomination today after results are in from the 4 GOP voting contests, which are taking place today, Georgia, Washington, Mississippi, and Hawaii. President Biden may also clinch the nomination today. Republicans in Georgia, Mississippi, and Washington are holding primaries while Hawaii is holding GOP caucuses. Democrats will be holding primaries in Georgia, Mississippi, Washington, and the Northern Mariana Islands. Also, Democrats abroad will be voting. Trump's major rival, as you know, Nikki Haley, has stepped away.
Right, people are voting overseas, but Pennsylvania will vote sometime in January.
How did we decide that our primaries were going to mean absolutely nothing?
Nothing.
Who decided that?
No skin in the game.
What about Super Tuesday? Can't we get in on that?
They're voting where? In London.
I don't even get it. That's from CBS News. Number 2. Authorities in Europe say they have foiled several terror plots, some involving suspects posing as refugees, raising alarm about a growing array of threats from extremists. In a Wall Street Journal exclusive today, the article talks about one previously unreported investigation last December, where police in Austria and Bosnia arrested 2 separate groups of Afghan and Syrian refugees who carried arms and ammunition, according to Kalashnikov assault rifles and pistols. Investigators found pictures of Jewish and Israeli targets in Europe on some of the suspects' mobile phones, which they said suggested they were motivated by Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. Listen, this is, as I said, an exclusive to the Journal today, and I think it's worth your time. Not for the purpose of being afraid, because God tells us not to be afraid, but just to be aware and to be in prayer about what's going on in Europe right now. That's number 2. I'll give you number 3. The Vatican Secretary of State is seeking to diffuse outrage over Pope Francis's last diplomatic statements. How about that?
Mm.
Insisting in media interviews that a primary condition for negotiations to end the war in Ukraine is an end to Russia's aggression and that any peace must be a just peace. Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Vatican's chief diplomat, made the rounds with friendly Italian media the same day as Kyiv summoned the Holy See ambassador to complain because the Pope made comments that Ukraine should have the courage of a white flag and negotiate an end to the war.
Yeah, that's not the devil there.
That's from ABC News. And number four, USA Today has named PNC Park the best ballpark in its rankings of Major League Baseball stadiums. Baseball reporters and editors from the USA Today network revealed the honor in a story you can read today, ranking MLB stadiums from 1 to 30, baseball travelers' favorite ballparks. And that's your top four at four.
That's fine. I'd rather play in Three River Stadium and see a winning team. I'd much prefer that.
I actually wouldn't.
What? Get out of here.
Listen. Listen.
There's no comparison.
Yeah, no, listen. There is something so healing about the atmosphere of a good ballpark that I mean, Three River Stadium was a terrible ballpark for baseball.
There was a lot of winning going on.
I know there was.
A lot of winning.
But you can't undersell the importance of environment.
So when the game's over, nine innings, you get up and go, well, we just got beat 12-0. That was worth it. No, it's not. At least the grass was pretty.
I guess you're right. But
no, I know.
But there's something. You got to be kidding. How many years do you think PNC Park's been there?
20.
24.
Woo.
Isn't that crazy?
I love it.
This is 24/7.
Long may PNC Park live.
Exactly.
Right, goodness. Okay, we'll take a quick break. When we do come back, the evil ideas behind October 7th. Mike Cosper is with us from Christianity Today. You're listening to Pittsburgh's Christian Talk. It's The Ride Home on 101.5 Word FM, WORD. Of course, war is still raging between Israel and Hamas. But the flashpoint, October 7th, what happened that day is still of very particular interest. Mike Cosper is with us. He's the founder of Harbor Media and director of podcasting for Christianity Today, where he has produced and hosted many wonderful podcasts. He's here today to talk to us, though, about the cover story in this month's Christianity Today that he wrote called The Evil Ideas Behind October 7th. The Hamas attacks in Israel have a grotesque ideological history and deserve unflinching moral judgment. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I appreciate the chance to talk about this.
Mike, since October 7th, unfortunately, John and I, and I'm sure you have read countless articles about what happened that day and what has happened since. But I feel like I have to give you kudos. This is an outstanding piece that you've written for CT. And it gets at the stories that we're telling each other about this conflict. And so I want to unpack that as our conversation goes forward. But let's begin here. First off, you were there on site. Talk about how you got access. Was this an invitation you were offered, or talk about your trip to the Middle East?
Yeah, so I went over about 5-6 weeks after the original attacks. The main onslaught, the main assault on Gaza had not quite begun yet, and it was the kind of thing where there was just a sense of burden on my part. Because part of what I recognized was that in the immediate aftermath of the attacks, I sensed that there was a tremendous amount of moral confusion, both inside and outside the church, about what do we make of these things? Because like you said, there are these stories that we tell about who the Israelis are, who the Palestinians are, who Hamas is, what's the nature of the conflict. And so I wanted to go and capture people in their voices and write about it and record some podcasts about it.
So there you go, Mike. You say that of 900 people who lived in Kfar Azah, 1 in 10 was murdered. I'm assuming that Kfar Azah was a kibbutz. Is that true?
That's correct. Yeah.
For our audience, describe what a kibbutz is like.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of what part of what makes the tragedy of October 7th so ironic is a kibbutz is essentially like a little tiny socialist utopia, right? Like people come together and they decide to live in community with one another. There's usually some kind of business. Originally, they were all farms. This is actually a manufacturing kibbutz, and this is as left wing as it gets inside of modern Israel. And these were peaceniks. These were people who wanted peace with the Palestinians. These were people who were working for peace, working for two-state solutions, providing jobs for people from Gaza who had permits to come over and work on the Israeli side. So the fact that they were the objects of, you know, several of these kibbutzim were the targets of these attacks, among the targets, makes it all the more tragic.
Mike, before you left, you heard tons of people saying October 7th was the deadliest day for Jews since the Holocaust. And you write that that was playing on a loop in your head as you were walking around. Can you talk about what you saw and why that was at the forefront of your thoughts?
Yeah, so this kibbutz was, you know, you just imagine a sort of densely packed neighborhood and these small homes, little simple homes packed in tightly next to one another. And we walked through it, and of course the place has been abandoned since the attacks. At the time, you know, at some point they'll rebuild. But they were so devastated, there's no one living there. But you walk through and you can just sense the presence of people. You can sense ordinary life just was sort of interrupted in the middle of someone making breakfast or whatever it might be. There's still cereal boxes on the counter and that sort of thing. But the other thing that you see is that the aftermath of the attacks. And so these homes, many of them were burned out. The Hamas terrorists would light fires in the middle of a home if they thought there was someone hiding in a safe room or something like that to try to drive them out with either the fire or the smoke. Many of the outsides of the homes were riddled with bullet holes or damaged by rocket propelled grenades and that sort of thing. So you just see these places where, you know, at one point you're standing at one point and there's just a pile of shell casings on the ground. And then you, in other places, you see these just sort of burn areas. I mean, it was long enough after the attacks that the bodies had been removed and all of that, but people were burned alive. Their bodies were burned after they'd been murdered. They were sort of summarily round up in groups and shot at times, and shot in front of one another, and shot in ways to sort of extend the humiliation and the pain of it. And so I couldn't help. I mean, as somebody, for me, it's, anti-Semitism has been something that I've sort of studied my entire life and written about many times before. I couldn't help but see the echoes of these other pogroms and atrocities, mm-hmm. and of course the Holocaust itself throughout this kibbutz as we toured it.
Mike Cosper is with us from Christianity Today, the cover story in this month's edition, The Evil Ideas Behind October 7th. Mike, you talk about the Israeli Defense Forces, and on October 7th, they intercepted a phone call from a Hamas terrorist to his parents. Please go into this, because this to me is an exclamation point about the hatred that Hamas has towards the Jewish state.
Yeah, he calls his mom and dad, and I mean, it's like, you know, it's the kind of phone call you could imagine a young person calling their parents to say, hey, I got into the right college, right? Or I got a promotion at work, or I got a promotion in the military, or whatever it was. He had taken an Israeli civilian's phone and had called his parents with it and was bragging about, I don't remember off the top of my head, but he was bragging about the number of Jews, you know, 8, 10, 12 Jews that he had personally murdered. And, you know, at one point he says to his mother, your son killed Jews, your son killed Jews, with this sort of enthusiasm and pride. And, you know, his mother's response is, I wish I was there with you. And it just goes to show you how deep this idea is embedded inside, you know, this idea that drives Hamas. There's this deep idea that Jews don't belong in the land, and that the urgent responsibility of Muslims is to drive them off the land. And of course, that doesn't apply to every Palestinian, doesn't apply to everyone, but to supporters of Hamas and to Hamas itself, like that is the driving motivation, is violence, terror, and death until the Jews are driven off the land.
And you make the point in your article, Mike, and I think you make it well, that Hamas is not the only group who has submitted to this sort of storytelling or ideology, because any group that is motivated purely by ideology thinks that whatever they're doing and whatever their compatriots are doing are just agents of the progress of history. So if, you know, if this is an inevitability, right, if history is progressing this way, then if we do whatever violence we're motivated to do, it's not really that bad because we're just basically making the, you know, the end result come faster.
That's right. Yeah. And part of what's, I mean, part of what I try to write about in the story as well is to just show the parallels between what you see on sort of left-wing campus groups and among, you know, the most activist wing of the left wing of the progressives in the United States, and the story that Hamas is telling. What they're both saying is that Israel is this settler colonial state, that it's a state that was founded by these white European Jews who came and stole the land, and that that ultimately, you know, it sets up this paradigm where because they're the oppressor and the Palestinians are the oppressed, you know, all the sort of moral distortions are now possible. Violence and you know, again, the things we saw on October 7th, the rape, the murder, the desecration of corpses, it's all justifiable because of this sort of original sin of the quote unquote settler colonials who came in and took the land. And what I try to do in the piece and what I try to address and what I think is so critical to this is that we have to examine that underlying story and just say, wait a second, is this true? Is that who the Israelis are? Is that who fundamentally this state is? And if it's not, which I would argue it isn't, then the number one, the Palestinian resistance project is doomed to fail because they're misunderstanding what they're up against. And so is the peace process. Until that fundamental underlying story is reaccounted for, the peace process will never move anywhere.
And Mike, because you've written extensively and thought and talked about anti-Semitism, I think for anybody, you know, of a certain age, to see the rise of anti-Semitism once again, it is shocking, the brutality of this. And we're back, it feels as though, on the precipice of, you know, the eve of World War II, you know, where the Jews are being rounded up. I mean, it just seems unbelievable that this is happening once again.
You know, it really is. I mean, it's simultaneously very shocking, and it's also not a surprise. Like, if you followed anti-Semitism historically, it's not a surprise because there is a cyclical nature to it. The nature is, and if you look through especially the past like 500 years of Western history, one of the things that you see is that anytime something goes wrong, whether it's a plague or a war or an economic downturn, whoever's in power tends to find a reason to blame the Jews for whatever has gone wrong.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it's not surprising, but I think because in the West we have told us this story that we're quite enlightened and things are we've learned from our history and we have never again bumper stickers and all the rest. We think, well, it would never happen here now. Obviously, we've been proven quite wrong about that.
Well, we have been. I mean, here you're talking to an audience in Pittsburgh, in Western Pennsylvania. I drive by almost every day the Tree of Life Synagogue, which is, you know, in the process of being torn down.
So and let me tell you, I never thought that would happen in Pittsburgh. Never in my wildest nightmares did I ever think that would happen in Pittsburgh.
But here it is.
Yeah, no, it's horrific. I mean, there's a really fantastic article by John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, called "They're Coming After Us," and it's an extensive account from him looking at the past 100 years of history of anti-Semitic violence, and what he documents so well and quite frighteningly, I would say, in that piece, is the ramp up of that violence in the United States. It's very disturbing.
Mike Cosgrove is with us, founder of Harbor Media, director of podcasting for CT, Christianity Today, and also the author of Faith Among the Faithless, Learning from Esther How to Live in a World Gone Mad. You might know Mike's voice from hearing his Cultivated podcast and the acclaimed Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. We need to take a break, Mike, so hang on and we'll be right back with you. It's the Tuesday edition of The Ride Home.
talking with Mike Cosper from Christianity Today. The cover story in this month's edition, The Evil Ideas Behind October 7th.
Mike, as we have this conversation about Hamas and Israel, we've only done it, I don't know, we've been talking for 7 or 8 minutes or something like that. I bet the majority of our listeners already feel like either you're on their side or you're on the wrong side. Because people have already decided what side they're on. John and I watched the Oscar telecast, and you can, you know, cheer us or pity us depending on your perspective. But we watched it beginning to end. And, you know, people, celebrities were wearing the red lapel pin, which was basically, you know, free Palestine. There was
a traffic jam outside the Oscars of Palestinian protesters who, you know, stopped the flow of those moviegoers to go into the Oscars.
What about the trio of Jewish folks?
The Zone of Interest, which won an Oscar. There was, you know, a statement that was read by the director of the film. All these things. I mean, still current, still vital to us to know more about this.
And their statement was basically saying, we're not Jews like Israel.
Right. We're the good Jews.
We're the good Jews. Yeah. So anyway, I guess my question is, there's a story that Hamas and Israel are telling, and I want to get to that in our next segment. But what about the story that we're telling each other now?
I think it's so critical. One of the things that's interesting is I grew up a Christian. I grew up in the church, and I'm a Cold War kid, right? Like, I grew up in the 80s. And so there was this interesting kind of alignment of, like, what it meant to be an evangelical and what it meant to be a conservative evangelical, of, like, Republican parents and of very much anti-communist kind of sentiments in my home and all of that. And so we were very, very pro-Israel. And there was, like, a theological reason and a political reason and all the rest of it. And I think part of what's happened in the United States is, in the last 25 years, you have another generation who's come up. And what the way they think about the Middle East, the way they think about war, has been so informed by, you know, by the, not the terror years themselves, but the aftermath of the terror years, the extended war in Iraq, the things we've seen from the Syrian civil war, the things we've seen from Afghanistan, the Abu Ghraib, the abuse of prisoners in Abu Ghraib.
Yep.
And I've wondered a lot how much ambivalence or outright hostility towards Israel in this conflict isn't informed by a lot of that, and isn't informed a bit by the lack of a sense that that there is such thing as the virtuous use of military power. You know, I remember hearing Tom Hanks one time talking about, like, somebody asked him about why he wanted to make the series Band of Brothers, and he said, you know, I've just always been fascinated by the fact that 75 years ago, a bunch of 18 and 19-year-old kids decided to get on a boat and sail across the ocean to go save the world. And I don't know that we can – I don't know that we have the moral imagination for that right now in the same way. And so the idea that there's this conflict where Israel is a richer nation, is a more powerful nation, does have this extraordinary military capability, I don't know that we can imagine a scenario in which someone who, because they have power – could be using that for the right reasons, for the right purposes, against a much less powerful force that is itself actually motivated by much more evil purposes. So that seems to be the obstacle. I mean, as this story's gone out, as I've interacted with people over it, I just find so often it's very difficult to get people to even imagine outside of that kind of a moral frame.
Right. At the same time, a couple of things. I mean, when you look at the landmass of the Arab world and see the little tiny dot, which is Israel, in the midst of all that, you see they're surrounded by people who hate them and wish nothing more than their destruction. And at the same time, of course, you know, the three of us in this conversation, no one wants to see the innocent slaughter of babies and women and men, you know, the civilians who have been caught up this. And clearly, tens of thousands of people have lost their lives in this.
And have been suffering for the last 30 years.
Right. So there's no easy solution here to peace, to the way out. And of course, people say ceasefire. Well, ceasefire is one thing. But better to eradicate Hamas and have a complete and total surrender with the return of the hostages, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the ceasefire leaves Hamas in place. So for Hamas, a ceasefire is a victory. And a ceasefire, apart from the surrender of Hamas's leaders and the return of the hostages, is not actually a ceasefire. It's not a truce. It's not an end of hostilities.
Yeah.
It's a victory for Hamas. They'll have humiliated Israel on the world stage. They'll have vilified them and have essentially said, you know, the story the world will tell is there was this terrible terrorist attack, and then Israel went way over the top in its response,
right,
and the global community had to go to the streets to protest to make them stop their brutality. The reality is the best hope for the people of Gaza is to eradicate Hamas so that there can be a new day. I mean, when you think about the fact that Hamas has been in charge of Gaza for, I think, 17 years. They've had sole leadership in that region. The only thing they have done is build a terrorist tunnel network, the most extensive terrorist tunnel network in the history of the world, that has forced the conflict to look the way that it does. That's the only thing they've done for the people of Gaza. And what Gaza, you know, what Gazans have got, you know, we have the reward to them for allowing that is the deaths of tens of thousands of their own civilians as Israel defends itself and says, we can't let this threat live on our border any longer. It's a horrific story. And until we see the story that way, it just perpetuates the conflict. It perpetuates this way of talking about it.
When we come back from the break, let's talk about the anti-colonial ideology that not only is, I think, motivating a lot of people in the Middle East, but certainly motivating the academy and the left here in America. Let's talk about the validity of that claim, whether it holds any weight, what historical records tell us. And we're going to look to Mike Cosper to be our guide for that. Founder of Harbor Media, director of podcasting for CT. You probably heard his voice in the acclaimed Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, but he's also written a bunch of books, including The Stories We Tell. We'll be right back. Tuesday edition. It is The Ride Home.
Talk with Mike Cosper from Christianity Today about the cover story in this month's edition of CT, The Evil Ideas Behind October 7th.
Mike, in your article, you take us to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the traditional place recognized as the site of the crucifixion and the resurrection. And you talk about how it's kind of a disorienting place. And when I think about anti-Semitism across the generations, I just finished a book on the history of France. And you can read the history of any European country, and it's just anti-Semitism is just baked into it. Christians having a large part in that. So can you talk about, for a long time, Christians being the proponents of anti-Semitic hate? It's not like we can point fingers here.
Yeah, for many Christians, I mean, you see this a lot in renewal movements in the church. There's this sort of moment where the church says, oh, we've had this historic hostility to Jews. We should reach out to Jews, and we should reconcile with them. And underneath that is often this assumption that, hey, if we reconcile with the Jewish community, they'll all convert. That's kind of Martin Luther's thoughts during the Reformation as well. And so early Martin Luther is very positive about what the Reformation might mean for Jewish-Christian relations. And then late Martin Luther is notoriously anti-Semitic because they didn't convert. He was quite upset about that. And there are these tropes that come along with it, because there's a sense in a lot of anti-Semitic literature that Jews themselves get blamed for the death of Christ, and so you get this idea of, you know, the trope is often referred to as the Jew as the God killer, and it's something that appears again and again, both in the Middle Ages and in the early church. But in modern history as well, and in the piece I talk about, you know, a specific example of that that's taking place even during this very war.
So this trope of colonialism, all right, and the anti-Semitism that goes with it, I mean, people will say, Well, you know, Israel's been there since 1948, which is a complete and absolute fabrication. This goes back thousands of years. I mean, for people not to know their history, biblical history or otherwise, it's just uninformed, yeah?
It is, yeah. So there's, you know, there's archaeological evidence going back at least 1,000 years before the birth of Christ, connecting the Jewish people to the land. And then there was a mass displacement in the second century because of the Romans put down a Jewish uprising and displaced a majority of the population. But there were always Jews in the Holy Land. There were always Jews throughout the Middle East. One quarter of Baghdad was Jewish at the turn of the 20th century. And so what begins to happen is in the 19th century, with the rise of nationalism, and in particular, with the rise of a real surge of anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe, you begin to see this notion of a new kind of Zionism, a new kind of Zionist vision, where Jews would come home to the Holy Land. And for many of them, they were secular Jews. They weren't motivated by religious reasons. They were motivated because this was their historic homeland. There were sort of legal and political reasons why there were openings for them to do so. And it was to escape pogroms. It was to escape mass murder from the East. And really with kind of every cycle of mass Jewish immigration, either, you know, before World War II, after World War II, the much of the emigration was displaced persons, Holocaust survivors who still didn't have legal status. They'd been stripped of legal status during the war by the Nazis, and that wasn't restored after the war, so they came as refugees. And then after the founding of Israel in 1948, almost all of the Arab states and many African states made their Jewish citizens stateless. They dispossessed them of any land, of any wealth, and they kicked them all out. And 600,000 Jews emigrated to Israel then because they had no place else to go. So this idea that it's a European settler state that where Jews came and stole land and sort of wealthy Europeans came and took over like any other imperial project, it's just simply not true. These were refugees, and Israel was kind of the last place for them to go, and that is the nature, that's the heart, the center of the conflict now.
And then how do we get in our own the stories that we are telling each other here in America? How have we flipped that? What are the things that have contributed to that? Because like I mentioned the Academy Awards a couple minutes ago. That was obviously the acceptable perspective, is that, we were not supporting, we were supporting a free Palestine. And by free, I think that the people at the Academy Awards were thinking it was a democratic Palestine that they were talking about. But you make clear in your article what Hamas is talking about is an area free of Jews.
Yeah, that's right. So the Palestinian national movement really takes off in the 1960s, and it takes off on the heels of the success of the Algerian revolution from the 50s and 60s. And what happens in Algeria is you have a million and a half French citizens. It's a colony of France, classic colonialism. The French come, there's natural resources, they plant the flag, they take the natural resources, they make the locals second-class citizens. And the Algerian Revolution is this incredibly violent revolution where the Algerian, the Algerians basically said, we're going to raise the cost of being here to the point where the French go home. So it was brutal, and in the end, the French went home. The French it became intolerable. It wasn't worth, the riches weren't worth the price that they had to pay to be there. And that ends in 1962, and then in 1964, the Palestinian Liberation Organization emerges, and it's really built on that model. It uses the same language. It uses the language of colonialism. A decade later, when Yasser Arafat is invited to speak at the UN, he was invited to speak by the Algerians. And so you then have a lot of the sponsorship that you get for the Palestinian nationalist movement comes from post-colonial states like Algeria and South Africa. That's why South Africa is the sponsor in the International Criminal Court right now, accusing Israel of genocide. But again, the problem is that while the movement was built on the model, it relies on a story that just that simply doesn't reflect the reality, that doesn't reflect the actual history of how that came about. I mean, one of the most remarkable things about the Israel story is that if you had talked to Israelis who were founding the state in 1948, many of them would say, yeah, we were an anti-colonial revolution, and we've been committing violence against the British Empire to try to get them off of our native land for the last decade, and they finally left.
Huh. Right. And what's interesting is, in all this mix, I mean, you know, we talk about this almost daily here on this show. Any news media covering this story, whether it's, you know, the mainstream New York Times or the Washington Post, it's always in the news. But when you look at the world of some 8 billion people, Jews are only about 15 million people worldwide. It is a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of anybody who walks the earth. And still, it's a center point of a lot of us.
Yeah, that's the spiritual aspect of this that I think is so important, because you're right. I mean, it's a tiny percentage of the world's population. 2% of the U.S. population is Jewish. So there's definitely something, you know, there's definitely something rare and remarkable about the fact that, number one, when anything goes wrong in culture, people turn to Jews to blame them, and number two, at one point, for instance, in recent history, I mean, I think this may still be the case. There are more reporters for the Associated Press assigned to Israel than are assigned to China.
Wow!
And,
really?
And there's 11 million people in Israel, and there's what, a billion
That's
or so
crazy.
In China. And so it just tells you there's something about this place, because of the. Because of the power of the story on the world stage, but also I think the spiritual aspects of it. There's something spiritual at work here, where the world can't look away from these people and this story and the intersection of Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, because it feels like history hinges on it in many ways, and as Christians, of course, we believe that it does.
Mike, I'm going to ask you a question that could have a really long answer, but I've only got 2 minutes in this segment. But
okay. So good luck with that.
Yes, I hope that goes well for you. But the portrayal of Jesus as Palestinian, I think a lot of us saw the nativity scene that was set up around the holidays that portrayed Jesus in the, I believe you pronounce it keffiyeh, which is, a lot of us would recognize that as maybe what Yasser Arafat wore.
Right.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I had real concerns about it. And what we talk about in the piece is just the history of the keffiyeh as not just a symbol of sort of Palestinian solidarity, which is how it's often presented, but really is a symbol of revolutionary violence, the kind of revolutionary violence that that led to the Second Intifada, to kids being blown up on buses and just horrific stuff. And so to me, it's quite appropriate to imagine Jesus in solidarity with people suffering under all kinds of conditions, including those who are suffering in Gaza at this moment. But to do so by wrapping him in the symbol of this kind of violence is just utterly inappropriate.
I'm into that. Mike, we're done here. We really appreciate your time and your reporting, your intellectual heft for all this. We know that you've got a brand new book out. Come back and talk to us at some point about that as well, would you?
I would love to do that. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, Mike, for people who want to hear more from you, can you just talk about the podcasts that you've got that are available and how people can find out more?
Yeah, so we have a weekly news and issues show called The Bulletin that comes out every Friday morning. And then I have a mini series that we've got 3 episodes out and 3 to go called Promised Land. And it's all coverage that we did while in Israel looking at these stories. So we talked to people in the Gaza envelope. We talked to people in the West Bank, Jews, Muslims, Christians. It was quite the experience.
Wow. I can't wait to sample that. Thanks so much for being with us, Mike. A real pleasure.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Take care.
You as well. Mike Cosper, the CT cover story this month, The Evil Ideas Behind October 7th. Do yourself a favor. Mike Cosper is all over the web, and follow along. His reporting is excellent, whether it's audio or print. Mike Cosper. That conversation with Mike Cosper. Now, of course, you're listening to Christian media here, but you will not hear that conversation on NPR mm-hmm. or CBS or other mainstream media. It's important to remember our roots as believers and to know what's happening in the mm-hmm. Middle East, and especially to look at the persecution and the murder of Jews worldwide as something that has deep resonance. It should echo within yeah. us as well as believers in Jesus.
And it's hard, though, John, to have the conversation, right? Because so much of it is political. And so left-leaning Christians could hear us talk and they're like, oh, great, these are just two more Republicans talking about Israel and Hamas.
But it's deeply spiritual.
But I think it is spiritual. And whether we're left or right, we have to be persuadable with facts. We have to be persuadable with evidence. And we truly scratched the surface of Mike Cosper's article in CT. But reading it, what he's saying is persuasive to me as just a person who's looking to learn more about the history of the area. And every attempt to equate, first of all, to call Israel a colonial power is absurd.
An occupier.
But the second thing, somehow equating the war that Israel is conducting in Gaza with what happened on October 7th is such an incredibly false comparison. It is an incredibly false comparison. And I think the reason that that comparison is raised so often is exactly what Mike said at the beginning. I think there's a segment of the United States all the West that can't accept that a military can do anything good, right? That a strong military can actually promote a good moral purpose, because we've seen so much of the opposite.
Of
I think that could be a lot of what we see.
I think that's true. But there is, of course, such a thing as just war. And we are not promoting the destruction of Palestinian women and children.
And we're not
people of peace.
And we're not saying that Israel's perfect.
No, of course not.
And that Israel has conducted itself perfectly in every regard. Of course, we know that is ridiculous, because no nation is perfect. No person is.
But again, do yourself a favor. Look at a map and look at Israel in the midst of an Arab world. They are truly a tiny pinprick surrounded by enemies who want nothing more than the destruction and the death of the Israeli state. There's no doubt about that. We see this again and again and again. Look, we're here in Pittsburgh. If you don't understand how people hate Jews, drive by what used to be the Tree of Life Synagogue. There it is. The rubble still exists there. So the rubble that's there in Squirrel Hill is akin to what's happened to the kibbutz in Israel on October the 7th. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing.
It is the same thing. It's the same thing. And lest we forget that the people that were butchered in the most western part of Israel were all peaceniks. These were
all
people that were advocating the two-state solution.
These were left socialists.
These were super lefties.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that Hamas came and mowed down. It wasn't like they were like pro-Netanyahu types.
Only because they were Jews.
Only because they were Jews.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We're going to step away. Just a little bit of little housekeeping here. Let me throw a hard turn to us. Next Thursday, Natalie Grant's in town at the Carnegie Music Hall of Homestead. That's next Thursday.
She's a gift. She's not just a singer. She's a gifted artist, I think.
We love her.
Yeah, I really like her a lot.
So if you've been thinking about this as the weather turns towards something beautiful, a nice night out, also Jeremy Camp, Amy Grant, they're also at the Carnegie Music Hall of Homestead. Check it out online, wordfm.com. We'll hope to see you there. Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for coming along today. A beautiful, an absolutely perfect Tuesday afternoon here in Pittsburgh and across western Pennsylvania. Okay, we've had growing up, there were a couple of guys in my group who were deaf. It's interesting. The mother and father were both deaf. They had like six kids in their family, and four of the kids were born deaf.
Okay. But there are two that weren't.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think probably, you know, this is like hereditary deafness, mm-hmm. fairly common, right? Well, I see in Wired magazine the story of six kids who were born with a type of hereditary deafness and are now part of a gene therapy trial of all places in China because it was developed by drug maker Eli Lilly here in the United States. But with one injection into this child, the deaf children, they're able to hear.
That's so incredible.
It is incredible. It's remarkable, says Lawrence Lustig, a hearing loss expert at Columbia University. There's never been a therapy that restores even partial hearing for someone who's totally deaf other than a cochlear implant. All children who were given this injection, as I said, born with a mutation in a gene that makes a protein needed for hearing called ofrelin. We hear things when sound waves in the air cause the thousands of sensory hair cells in our inner ear to vibrate and then release a chemical that relays the information to the brain. Ofrelin is necessary for the release of this chemical message. Without it, the ear cannot communicate. So this injection creates that cell and allows the person almost, it happens almost instantaneously. Can you imagine thousands and thousands of people were brought to hearing?
I can't imagine that.
Yep.
Wow.
So anyway, the story's at Wired magazine. Of course, anybody in your circles who is deaf, to think about this, especially hereditary hear loss, hearing loss, just a fabulous story.
Wow. In our last hour, we had the pleasure of talking to Mike Cosper about the Hamas-Israel conflict. And if you missed any of that, I highly suggest that you contact our podcast because mm-hmm. it was really, I don't know, for me, in preparing for the interview and talking to Mike, it was really thought-provoking, and I really appreciated it. Anyway, you can find Mike our Cosper. Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on, I don't know, 40-plus platforms or something, so I'm sure you can find it wherever you look. And also coming up in this hour, generational curses. Are they a real thing? You know, like the sins of the father are visited on the...
Yeah.
Like, is that God saying he's going to do it? Like, he's going to punish that... I don't know.
It's a wild topic.
We're going to talk about it in a little bit with Dr. Roger Olson. But before any of that, John,
yeah.
It's a Tuesday, and that means we have 5 at 5.
5 at 5.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yep. So basically, I'm going to give you 5 things, John. Do you have a writing implement?
I do.
Do you have
a piece of paper?
Do you have a piece of paper?
Before me.
I'm going to read 5 things, and you're going to rank them
okay.
on a scale of 1 to 5. 1 being most important, 5 being least important.
All right.
Are you ready to proceed?
You're kicking off, and I'm receiving.
Number 1.
Yes.
C.S. Lewis.
All right.
Number 2. John Steinbeck.
Oh.
Number 3. William Shakespeare.
Oh, well, this is horrible.
Number 4, Stephen King.
All right.
Number 5, John,
yep.
David McCullough.
Oh, boy.
Son of Pittsburgh.
All right. C.S. Lewis, John Steinbeck, William Shakespeare, Stephen King, and David McCullough. All right. Let me list these. Uh-huh. Let me go at this. All right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right now he's mm-hmm. busily putting numbers next to names.
Yes.
I've tried to make this as miserable as possible for John.
Okay. All right. I'm done.
Can imagine this.
Okay. Here's my list. Number 5.
Yeah.
Stephen King.
Okay.
I mean,
he sold a kajillion books.
He is.
Truly.
And of course, you know, under the genre of horror writing.
Yeah, right.
He's way beyond that.
He's so far beyond that.
He's such an excellent storyteller.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, if you haven't read or for whatever reason you're fearful of delving into some Stephen King, do yourself a favor. Short stories, long stories.
Watch Shawshank.
The Stand, all those different things. I mean, we're fortunate to have him, despite his little crazy politics.
Mm-hmm.
I love Stephen King. Number 5. Number 4.
How do you feel about this? This is going to be horrible, isn't it?
David McCullough.
Oh!
Number 4. I mean,
he's won the Pulitzer Prize. Dare I say
yes,
that?
Yes, he has. He's won the Pulitzer Prize. He is one of us.
Yes.
He is a Pittsburgher. We have fertile soil here in Western Pennsylvania for some fine writers. David McCullough.
We were with him in person. Shook his hand.
Yes, we did.
And wasn't that night incredible?
Fantastic.
but you've got him at number four.
Multiple bestsellers. The Truman novel, of course.
John Adams.
Yep. I mean,
The Wright Brothers.
You name it.
Pioneers.
Probably 30 books to his name, at least. Yeah, David McCullough, number four. Number three, John Steinbeck.
Also, I believe he won the Pulitzer Prize.
He did,
as well.
Of course. Yes. I mean, Grapes of Wrath, Of Mice and Men. I mean, you name it. I mean,
Cannery Row.
Yep. John Steinbeck, Travels with Charlie. I love him. I mean,
he's one of your favorites, right?
He is. I would say he is the, at least for that era, the most authentic American voice.
Yeah.
People would read Steinbeck and go, this is America. Or at least it was America.
Sure.
That's Steinbeck. Number two, C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
I mean, of the canon of writers that you should know about as a believer in Jesus Christ and his fantastical storytelling, right?
Incredible.
C.S. Lewis.
And his apologetic
thing.
Why, look, I'm helping you. Why? I should just be sitting here receiving.
It's a deep, incredible mind, C.S. Lewis. Of course, number one, though, William Shakespeare. He is the bard for a reason. All the varieties of plays and anything, sonnets, you know it. Everything I believe in Western literature springs from the mind of William Shakespeare. Comedy, tragedy, and everything else in between. He is number one in the world. Hopefully forever. Generational curses. Is that a thing? Roger Olson is with us. Dr. Olson has been a regular guest of our show over the years, emeritus professor of Christian theology at Baylor University, author of more than 20 books, including The Story of Christian Theology and The Journey of Modern Theology. Roger, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you again.
Always a pleasure.
Roger, talk about how you understand that phrase, generational curse.
Well, it might mean something a little different to each person, but putting them all together, I would say it generally means that there is some kind of spiritual, I don't know what other word to use than curse, that is passed down from one generation to another, especially if there is a sin in one generation, a father, for example, and then his children tend to not necessarily bear the punishment for that, but bear the strain of that in their lives, that their lives will be under some kind of curse of temptation, for example, just because their father gave in to that temptation.
Right. So a generational curse is not necessarily a DNA thing. This is something that is spiritual, perhaps psychological as well, yes?
Well, I think in the circles that I've heard it discussed, it's spiritual. Mm-hmm. It's not psychological or biological. It's purely spiritual.
So that's different then, Roger, than, you know, people saying, you know, alcoholism is hereditary, or, you know, certain disorders or predilections are passed on through a genetic way.
Right. Now, it's possible that somebody does use the term generational curse for that. But the charismatic and Pentecostal people that I know who talk about generational curses mean something different than that. It's not anything that science could study. It's more akin to something demonic, although it isn't necessarily demonic, but it's a spiritual force that is that connects parents and children and grandchildren and down through the generations. So it could be all the way back to a great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. Now, an example of that is that I've seen studies promoted showing that Jonathan Edwards' descendants were good people and godly people, God-fearing people, whereas a man who lived in the same town, I believe it was Northampton, Massachusetts, at the time of Jonathan Edwards, who was sort of the town drunk, that all of his descendants were cursed in some way, not just with alcoholism, but just generally their lives were totally messed up. Because of this passing down of a generational curse. It's not scientific, though. It's not something that science could study.
Hmm. So then, I guess the question for us is, when you think about generational curses, do you, because you're the author of this piece at the Pathos blog, do you, Roger, believe in generational curses?
No, I do not.
Tell us why.
Well, for one thing, Ezekiel 18, and I'll just let your readers look it up and read the whole chapter, seems to me to cancel the idea, which may have been prominent among many of the Jewish people, something like it anyway, going back to the Exodus, because the book of Exodus does say something like that. It's hard to reconcile the two passages. I'm sure that they're reconciled in God's mind, even if not in ours. But the later one interprets the earlier one, and I'd say Ezekiel 18 really contradicts the concept, and I'll let your readers look it up. But I also think that it borders on superstition, and third, it can lead to people being accused who are totally innocent of their parents, grandparents, ancestors' sins. So, you know, I know a man, for example, whose father or great-grandfather was homosexual secretly and lived a secret homosexual life. And he's been confronted by fellow charismatics several times when they found out about that and saying, well, you must have that too.
So the idea of original sin mixed into this, I mean, generational curses, original sin, are they one and the same? Could they be?
No, but it depends on how you define original sin. Now, the Catholic Church, in its official teachings, believes that original sin is inherited guilt because of Adam. Many Protestants agree with that. Certainly Luther did, and many other Protestants have. We who are Baptists and Anabaptists and most Pentecostals would not agree with that, but would talk about original sin as universal sin, that because of Adam, the whole human race is fallen under a curse. And that curse is that we are born with a tendency to sin. But I don't think that extends to kind of a, you know, father sin, therefore I have to sin the same sin unless I'm delivered. And that's another element that needs to come in here, is that this whole thing of generational curses aims toward deliverance ministry. It's part of deliverance ministry, which is not only casting out demons, but casting out generational curses.
Interesting. So then with that layer of generational sin, deliverance, what about exorcism? I mean, that's a pretty common thing in this world today, even today.
Right. So exorcism, as I understand it, is always the prayerful casting out of a demon. And I don't think that people who promote the idea of generational curses connect it with demon possession. In my understanding, and I've talked to many people who believe in it and read some things about it, it's not so much a demon as a temptation that's very, very strong that passes down to you just in a almost quasi-biological but spiritual way. And it ultimately can only be broken with intense prayer like exorcism.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, how does behavior fit into this? Because it's obvious that you can see I don't want to say that they're temptations, but certain tendencies repeat in families. And so you see, you know, like I mentioned alcoholism earlier, or you can see, you know, anxiety or depression or things like that. And so if you're saying that you're not looking at that spiritually, how do you look at that?
Well, I do think that there's a genetic component to that. Increasingly, scientists are discovering genes that incline a person toward alcoholism addiction. There's kind of a belief, anyway, among genetic scientists in an addiction gene. And I would say that most of the time that is a biological thing, even if we haven't fully understood it yet. That, and I'm talking merely there about the, you know, not so much, I wouldn't call it generational curse, as we inherit traits from our parents. Yes, no doubt about that.
And so that's a reality that we have to understand.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Nature and nurture. There's a strong nature component in our behavior. But I would say that when it comes to spiritual sinning, it would be more a matter of influence. Our parents have tremendous influence over us.
Yes.
But it's not like there's a spiritual disease they pass down to us that has to be prayed out of us or something.
Mm-hmm. But it is true, though, right? If your father was an alcoholic and you saw your father in his alcoholic rage or pleasure or whatever that manifested itself as, you as a young man or a young woman would see that and would be perhaps more inclined to engage in that because you've seen this behavior exhibited? There is that passing of down?
I do know people, though, who have gone the other way,
mm-hmm.
who have
yes.
determined not to be like their parents.
Right, right. So the pattern's Whereas, there. It's yeah. up to the person to choose to right. which direction they want to go.
Right, yeah, that's what I believe. And I think Ezekiel 18 supports what I believe.
So
and
then,
again, I'll leave it to your listeners to read that.
So then the fulcrum here, Roger, is the idea of a curse, right? That you think a curse is a superstition
and
not
the,
an actionality.
And in this understanding, the curse would be from what source? That would be demonic? Or I think some people believe that God cursed them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I think the people I know who believe in generational curses believe it's demonic.
Hmm. Okay.
But they're reluctant to say that because they know where that will lead. You know, there are churches that specialize in exorcising their own members and anyone their members bring to them. The whole Sunday evening service of a church in Waco, Texas that I knew about was exorcising demons from people.
Really? As new people came in?
Completely out of control. Yeah.
What the heck? Welcome to our church. Now let's do an exorcism.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. That's an interesting welcome committee.
That's rough.
All right. Well, again, Roger, we've talked to you for so long over so many years. We appreciate your presence on the show.
Very interesting, Roger.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Truly, the pleasure is ours. Roger Olson, Pathios is a very interesting blog, and Roger often posts there as well, but the author of over 20 books, The Story of Christian Theology, The Journey of Modern Theology. We've been talking to Dr. Roger Olson, a Christian theology professor emeritus at Baylor University.
Does this make sense?
Does what make sense?
Canned soup. You walk into a grocery store, it might be 65 kinds.
Yeah.
You got your cream of mushroom, your tomato, your chicken noodle, your...
Wedding.
Hungry man, your
yep.
whatever.
Makes perfect sense.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've eaten my share.
Have you? Yeah, me
of
too.
Canned soup.
Sure, me too.
And rarely does it disappoint. Here's the thing about canned soup. 3.5 minutes.
Right.
I'm good to go.
Mm-hmm.
I've got something in my gut.
Mm-hmm.
It's been satisfying for the most part. It's not like, you know, the high culinary.
Lots of variety.
Sure. Lots of salt.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, for years, I'd go over to the Giant Eagle here and get myself a can of wedding soup.
Mm-hmm.
And that'd be my lunch.
Mm-hmm.
It hit the spot. It
sure.
makes perfect sense.
Sure.
Does it make sense to you?
Nope.
What? Get out of
Listen
here.
Listen to me.
Come on, Cap.
Listen when I tell you this.
Please. Come on now.
Soup is like the easiest thing in the world to make. It is so easy. Mm. You can't believe how easy it is. It's not as easy as opening a can. But it's super easy.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure people will lift soup to like a high culinary level.
Sure,
I'm sure
course.
It's harder.
The soup Nazi.
But exactly. But on your base soup level, it's super easy.
Pretty basic.
And so when I walk into a store and I look at all this, I think, you know what, this doesn't make sense.
Okay.
This doesn't make sense. You mentioned the sodium. I don't think we all need that.
Huh.
Doesn't make sense, John.
Well, it's the end of soup season.
Well,
isn't it?
Okay.
Kind of.
What about the gazpacho? That's
yeah,
the summer
yes,
soup.
Yeah, there I am, opening my big mouth. All right, does this make sense? Hard work.
Huh. Yes, in every way, whether it's acknowledged, seen, or not, it always 100% benefits the person.
Wait, now, what about quiet quitting?
No.
Just mailing it
That's
in.
Just
what about the bare minimum?
Don't you have any self-respect? Don't you have any allegiance to, you know, being a positive influence in the world? Don't you want to get up and make something of yourself? Don't you want to help out your fellow man? Don't you want to advance, you know, the cause of Christ?
Stop
Don't
it.
Come on. It's a beautiful, complex, fascinating world out there. Don't you want to learn more about it? Don't you want to investigate it? Don't you want to proclaim the goodness of God, John?
Okay, I guess you got me.
Good grief.
Hard work makes sense.
Yes.
Right? So this idea of, you know, kids just, it's enough. It's good enough.
You're going to waste Your life?
Mm-hmm.
Don't waste your life.
Sometimes you're around people and they work so hard and not working. You ever see that?
Oh, my gosh. And then they think, I'm so bored. Right. Listen, I was never allowed to say that when I was a kid.
Don't be bored.
Don't be.
There's many things to do.
There are countless things to do.
Hard work, make some soup. Have you done this? You're somewhere, you know, maybe out in public or even in your home, and you think, you pat your pocket and go, well, where's my phone?
Mm-hmm.
Where's my phone? And then you get this crazy sinking feeling, especially if you're out in public, like, I've left my phone behind.
Yep.
I'm a person non grata. I'm at sea.
I have nothing. I can't contact a person.
Exactly.
I can't buy anything. I'm basically lost to family and self.
Yes, I'm dead in the water. That is how significant the power of the phone holds over most of us. And that is, you know, here, supposedly an adult perspective. Now, Pew did a little sort of survey where they talked to kids between the ages of 13 and 17 as of last October. 1,453 U.S. teens took this survey. And it's really interesting that in the broadest sense, a majority of teens who were surveyed say that they feel happy and peaceful without their smartphones.
Younger kids, I'm talking particularly girls between 13 and 14, say that the harms of a phone outweigh the pluses mm-hmm. of a phone. Now, as people get older, they say that less. Like older teens don't say that as much, but younger girls in particular recognize how harmful a phone is. Listen, the mind of the 13-year-old girl is a complicated place.
I bet.
It is and it is consumed with comparison. You are constantly comparing yourself, your appearance, your intelligence, your clothes, your everything to all the girls around you. This is just a thing that girls do.
Not only all the girls around you, but to all the celebrities who are advertising.
So that's the thing. Before phones, it was just the people all around you.
Right.
But now with a phone, all the people around you has multiplied by like 100,000.
Right.
So now you're comparing yourself to celebrities. You're comparing yourself to professional athletes, to models, to you name it.
So it's just an impossibility.
It is an impossibility. But the fundamental part of the female brain, developing brain, stays the same, which is what makes social media so dangerous for young girls in particular. I know it's dangerous for young boys for different reasons,
sure.
But I'm just speaking as a girl and as the mother of girls that it's just for that reason, it's so dangerous.
Do you know that fully 95% of teens in this country have access to a smartphone?
Yeah.
Six in 10 of those kids, 13 to 17, that they say that they use every day, either TikTok, Snapchat, or Instagram. But the question was to these teens, do you think you spend too much time on screens? And this is telling, 4 in 10 teens said that they spend too much time on their phones.
Mm.
Just 4 in 10, right? The smartphone. And of course, girls lead that charge. Girls would say, yes, I do spend too much time on my phone. Guys, less so. Teen girls are more likely by 44 to 30% say that they spend too much time. A minority of teens have taken steps to reduce their screen time. Roughly 4 in 10 teens, 39%, said that they have cut back on their time on social media. A similar share said that they says the same about their phone. Still, most teens have not limited their smartphone use, 63%, or social media use, 60%.
Well, because their brains are not developed enough yet to make good choices. So the phone is the worst thing they could possibly have because they're going to look at it and say, oh, I don't really think I spend too much time on that. But you're 14. What do you know about anything?
Nothing.
You know what I mean? I think we give kids way too much credit in being able to make their own choices about things. I know it's a fight. I mean, I have children. I know what it's like. And I was a child myself. I remember fighting with my mom and dad. But I just really think we give way too much latitude to somebody who's 15 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, right? I mean, it's a battle here that is new to this generation. When do you allow your child to have a phone, if ever, right? I do know some parents who are like, well, my kids are 18 and they can get their own phone. But most kids get a smartphone, but at least by the time they're 14.
Right. I was sitting around talking, my husband and I, our two kids, and my future son-in-law. My younger daughter's getting married in a couple months. And we were talking about smartphones. And both of my kids, who are 25 and 22, said, and so did my son-in-law, they said, we're the last generation that knew any time without smartphones.
Right.
So when they were growing up, you know, I think they each got a phone when they were 14, which looking back on it was not the right decision.
No, of course not. But
they're saying the next generation has never known life without a smartphone. And so they both feel like they got phones when they were too young.
Mm-hmm.
All three of them think that they were not prepared for all of the temptations that were going to await them in the internet. And they all agreed that their parents, including my husband and I, weren't aware of what was going on. We just did not know
the depth of it all. And again,
you tend to give credit to your kids in ways that you really shouldn't.
Right. My kids are.
Oh, my kids would never do that. You think, why would they never do that? I mean, you remember being a kid, right? So there's just a lot of blame to go around, and I'm certainly taking my share of it. But it's just an interesting idea to think that we've passed the Rubicon, and now everybody is changed.
So you don't hear, or do you hear? Because I don't feel like as though I do, and of course I'm like you. My kids are grown now, but you don't hear a lot of conversation about the toxicity of phones and how we can best approach them and wall our kids off from this. It's a free pass.
Well,
we just go.
Yeah, you're right. But our producer, Lexi Merritt, who has the day off today, she talks openly about how young she was when she got a phone and how that wrecked a lot of her development when she was going through junior high and high school. Absolutely wrecked. I think there are a lot of kids that are having that conversation.
Of course. You know it wrecks kids' lives.
Yeah, but they're having the conversation with each other. They might not be talking to their parents about it like my kids are. I don't know. But they are having that conversation with each other.
But it's too little, too late.
It is.
But as a cautionary tale for new parents to think, okay, let's hit the reset button. This generation, we've plowed them under with every sort of manifestation of perversion and violence and any idiocy that we sent there into their little tiny brains and ruined them in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. Made them fight struggles that are well beyond their years.
Yes, for sure.
So how do you hit the reset button and go, okay, we've done this, what? When's the first smartphone? 2007? I don't know.
Six?
Right? It feels like they've always been with us. So is there a generational reset where we go, this is too much?
Well, interesting you've asked that question, because that came up in the same family conversation where my daughter and her fiance getting married in a couple of months, they both said, our kids will not have cell phones until they're 18.
Okay, well, it's
because they both suffered from having their phones. So that I guess that remains to be seen, but that's their goal.
Right. So a new generation, the first ones in who have suffered through this, will they have the wherewithal and the strength and the wisdom and the vision to say, not happening on my watch, you're not going to get a phone?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what that's like. I mean, now you think phones are one thing, tablets, PCs, laptops. We are surrounded by, look, I mean, I'm checking out a giant eagle. I'm on someone's screen, a giant eagle.
Right.
I mean, what the heck?
Yeah.
They're everywhere.
They are everywhere. But I also love it at the same time as I hate it.
Of course you do. I do too.
I'm watching a show last night. This is a stupid example, but I'm just giving you the first one that popped into my head. Watching this HBO show that you talked me into. I'm letting you have way too much influence over me.
It's pretty good though, right?
It is a really good show. Anyway, and so I see somebody and I instantly have to stop the show.
Right.
And say, well, what do I know him from?
Right.
And I have to go to IMDb and,
right.
Oh, right. It was that show. You know, I'm a curious person and I just like having my curiosity scratched
immediately.
Well,
that's that popcorn brain we've all talked about.
I know,
right?
It is. Like, I can't even watch a good show because I have to look up something about, you know, the actors who are in it.
I can't tell you the difficulty I have reading a novel.
Yeah, it's you have to really work at it, right?
I do. I have to schedule the time and sit there and read a chapter and really, really work. I mean, wrestle with concentration levels. So I have to put my phone out of the room. I can't be tempted by this.
Right.
I mean, it truly does. It feels like the devil is sitting right there with me.
Isn't that hard? So my husband and I were talking about YouTube the other night. And he's brought this up countless times about how, you know, you might be interested in.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know how that comes up. Right. So on my YouTube, the things that come up that I might be interested in are things about travel, right? Things about bags, because I particularly love to buy bags, like luggage,
purses.
Okay. I'm very much into bags. I feel like I could blame Gary Dixon for that. But anyway, I'm very into bags. So that always comes up. Skincare comes up.
Sure.
On my husband's YouTube, he, of course, guitars come up because it's what he does. And music comes up. And there's always something about a 20-year-old girl.
What?
There's always some, like...
tickle.
Yeah. There's just a little thing. Maybe it's on a Facebook reel or maybe it's on Instagram reel. But there's a little thing. It might just be one out of 12, but there's one that says, hey, you know, are you a 50-year-old male looking for companionship?
Oh, my gosh.
And it's all and it's not always browsing history.
Can you give me the address?
It's not always browsing history.
Right.
It's just it's what your age is and what they think people your age will want.
Because they know you and they want to entice you into something.
Right.
So –
he and my future son-in-law are having this conversation, right?
Yeah.
He's talking about that. My future son-in-law is like, try being 22 because it comes after you.
Porn.
Yes.
All sorts of videos.
It just comes after you. And he said, and you can say to yourself, okay, well, that's just browsing history. He said, I promise it's not browsing history. It is my age. It is coming after me.
Uh-huh.
That's how he feels.
The algorithm.
It is coming after me. So I was talking about the dangers of being online for young girls. That's the danger
for young men.
For men in general.
Of course, right. There's no doubt about it. You're just surrounded by it. There's no way out. All in the, you know, the throes of let's make a buck. Someone somewhere is making hundreds of millions of dollars or making a living, right?
Right.
Feasting on the minds and hearts, the souls, the spiritual life of our young men and women.
Right.
And we allow it.
And we sit here because we don't know what to do about it. Okay, before we break, I want to bring out the Kate Middleton story. She had abdominal surgery and there was a lot of secrecy around it. Because, I mean, people tend to think that because she's a royal that everybody has, you know, the right to her medical records.
Right.
But anyway, now that she's out of the hospital, she released a photograph of her with her children.
Yeah.
And which I looked at and didn't really think anything of it. But apparently, if you look at it more closely, you realize that a portion of it is photoshopped and photoshopped badly.
Oh, what is it?
So it's her hand. It's her left hand. So she's kind of bending down. She's bending down.
Yeah.
And she's got three children and she's got her arms around her kids.
I see. So the hand is distorted by the cuff of her sleeve.
Right. So her left hand, if you look at it closely, it just looks weird.
Right. So, of course, then this went out. And all the internet sleuths, those who are invested in the royals, of course, you know, there's a cross-section there of many, I'm sure, hundreds of millions in this world. They saw that and were like, wait a second. What is someone's trying to get over on us, whether this is AI or the royals themselves. Turns out, though, it's a lot more innocent.
It is.
Because Kate Middleton says, oh, this was a family photo. I'm the culprit. I'm the one who's editing these photos poorly. And then I put it out there.
And so all the people that were saying, wait, this is a conspiracy. Kate Middleton's dead.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like they're making up pictures of her with her children or she's incapacitated or she's I don't know what. But the reality is that Kate Middleton was like, so I'm not very good at Photoshop. Why she would do that?
Won't do it again.
She won't do it again, clearly. But I mean.
But everybody
does it. Right. But we might have, you know, you and I might have, I don't know, 1,000 people that look at a photograph we put up. She's going to have, you know, 100 million people looking at a photograph she put up.
Why don't you Photoshop? I just edit. I just, you know.
Yeah, so do I. But I'm saying if we did that, you know, I'm just saying our sphere is small. Hers is so gargantuan that, you know, you're inviting a lot of criticism and notice.
So here we are. We're all swimming together in this, and I would call it, truly, it is a cesspool of media invention where 20 years ago, this didn't exist. And so us, me, you, our children, our grandchildren, we're the first generation. We are the guinea pigs. How will this play out in 30 years, 50 years? What will be the new thing that will captivate us, make us sit up with attention so that we can buy product? Because that's what it's all based around, right? It's all just chasing a dollar and our involvement with that. You know, here's what kills me. When you're driving in your car, how many times do you see people swerving from lane to
lane? Oh, my gosh, because they're looking at their phone.
They're looking at their phone.
While they're driving.
The horror of that. How many accidents because of that?
I know.
Anyway, let the buyer beware. And our poor children, God bless them. We can do better for them. We need to. Well, we are approaching the season. That would be outside, perhaps lying on a blanket in your backyard or on a beach, if you're so inclined, to get the tan of your life. And it's weird to think that even in, you know, in this age where bells are ringing and saying, skin cancer, make sure you have sunscreen on every time you go out, that there are many people among us who, according to this article in the Washington Post, would rather die hot than ugly. And that includes a visit to tanning beds, whether your own tanning bed or a place that you go to and lay your cash down to sit and sizzle for a while. You ever tempted?
I've never been in a tanning bed.
Neither have I.
Never. Were you? Okay, you asked me if I was ever tempted.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think it just, it seems like that's an accident waiting to happen.
That's what I think. I'm always afraid, like, if I would, first of all, when so, I'm not going to, hopefully I don't offend anybody out there. It's not my aim. But when you see people who do tan, you think, well, they're going to a tanning salon.
Right.
And not that, you know, it's a moral failure or anything. It's just an aesthetic. It's the look that you would prefer.
Right.
Not my look.
Right.
I'm pasty.
Right. Right. I mean, I love to be out in the sun.
Yeah, of course.
But there's just no way I'm getting in one of those
tanning
little compartments.
Mm-hmm.
There's just, I'm just not doing that.
My sisters used to lay outside in the yard and put
baby oil. And sun in.
Oh my.
In their
and
hair.
Sun in, of course.
Right.
Like one of my kids used to use sun in when he was a little teenager. Oh, look at him. Beautiful blonde hair. It kind of looked orange, to be honest, right?
Yeah. And my mom used to say, though, everybody looks healthier with a suntan.
It's true.
Right.
You do. There's a certain glow to everybody, right?
There is.
And I think that's what drives people.
Yeah, of course. But the problem is that it's aging over time.
Right. So in this article, they talk about that. What really interests me a lot is sort of like the notion of the history of that bronze look. I mean, you know, it goes back to, you know, in this article that I'm reading in today's Washington Post. Well, Roman soldiers loved the idea of that bronze look. Right. They
really?
Would wear minimal clothing and their wives, you know, dressed in their finery, what they would imbue in the sunshine.
Is that right?
Right. Now, in the modern world, I mean, you look at, you know, what that was, the industrial age drove everybody inside, right? The 20s, the 30s, the 40s. And really, tanning didn't come into vogue until the 1960s and really reached its zenith in many ways in the 1970s. Because that's when tanning salons first made their appearance.
Huh.
Their popularity exploded among the maximalism of the 1980s. They appeared to reach their peak in the early aughts when the fascination with tans even spawned a short-lived e-reality show called Sunset Tan.
That was a show?
Yep. The pilot episode broadcast in May of 2007, a time capsule for the era. The first client is none other than Britney Spears.
No way.
Big eyebrow-raising moment comes when a woman walks into the shop with her daughter wearing a plaid dress, clearly a school uniform. The girl appears no older than 12. The mother says to her daughter that you need a tan for your school pictures. And so with the encouragement of an employee, they land on the Lindsay Lohan special, a combo of tanning bed and spray tan. And you're off to the races. I don't know.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, the current conventional wisdom for skincare is that you should be wearing, if you're a woman and you want to minimize aging,
yeah,
you should be wearing sunscreen every day.
Sure. I mean, they
every
sell cosmetics, right?
Like, just to go to work, you should be wearing...
Right, SP 40,
right,
whatever.
Right. I would never do that.
Really?
No. No, I don't... I'm not convinced... I mean, certainly when I go out in the sun, if I'm at the beach, I'm going to put on sunscreen.
Yeah.
But I'm not convinced that overexposure to SPF products is really in our best interest. Mm-hmm. I just think you're putting a lot of stuff on your skin.
So it's one or the other. It's too much skin, too much sun, or too
right.
much product.
And a lot of us have low vitamin D levels anyway. We need more sun. I don't feel like I'm just not a big advocate of SPF.
I mean, to me, when you go back to the 60s or the 70s, the early sun god was George Hamilton.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
Right?
Right. In his tuxedo. I can see him in his tuxedo,
yeah,
and his, like, his vampire haircut.
Exactly. People were like, look at that tan. I mean, known for his tan. What if George Hamilton's still alive? I bet he is.
Huh.
If he is, he's super old.
And look at who would be tanning now? Like, who are...
Former President Trump.
Oh.
What, are you kidding me? You walked into that.
I sure did.
Yeah. Who would be tanning now?
Who would be tanning
now? That's the
now?
Image, right?
Yeah.
George Hamilton is 84.
84.
Okay.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay.
I'm sure he's still
well,
tanned.
And you have people like Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
He looked great at the Oscars.
Well, who has a beautiful skin color anyway, and people want that. Or like, you know, you've got...
Bradley Cooper at the Oscars.
Right.
He looked great.
Yeah. So people want, you know, some kind of... skin tone that's different than what they
so a suntan
have.
Doesn't necessarily equate healthy, right? Especially if
no.
you're going to a tanning salon and laying down cash on a regular basis.
Forget that. No capsule.
All right. But you do look good in a tan.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.